The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
John Lauro and his team, which are Trump's attorneys, are making the point that Judge Chutkan, from these comments, is biased, or at least there is an appearance of bias, that she believes Donald Trump was behind the events on January 6th and that he should be charged accordingly. Now, what's a little bit awkward about this brief, it's awkward because it seems like defense counsel is implicating their own client. At no point does Judge Chutkan explicitly say that she's referring to Donald Trump in the two previous cases. And it's a conclusion that John Lauro and his team are drawing in this brief.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 16th, 2023. It's another week, and it's another episode of Trump's Trials and Tribulations, our weekly video conversation with Lawfare editors and writers on the ongoing Trump trials. On Thursday afternoon, I sat down in the virtual jungle studio with Sarafine Danani, Roger Parloff, and in a hideous pink chair, Anna Bauer. We talked about what's going on in Mar-a-Lago. We talked about what's going on in Fulton County. We talked about what's going on in Judge Tanya Chutkan's courthouse in Washington. Is she going to recuse herself? And we talked about Section 3 litigation under the 14th Amendment in Colorado, Minnesota, and elsewhere. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Trump Trials and Tribulations, an update from courthouses around the country. Anna, why don't you get us started? There was a hearing in Fulton County Court today. It was televised. Tell us what happened.
Right. So there was a hearing in Fulton County Court today. It was a motions hearing. Judge McAfee, who is the presiding judge over the case in state court in Fulton County, decided to hear three motions today. One was a motion to speak with grand jurors that had originally been submitted by Chesbro. And it seemed that his team is kind of gearing up to potentially make an argument challenging the indictment based on this claim that the grand jury only heard a summary of the indictment. His team has suspicions that that was the case. And so they said that they potentially want to make some kind of challenge to the indictment on that basis. So they've asked to speak or communicate with the grand jurors to ask them about the grand jury process. Then there is a motion to unseal special grand jury transcripts. The special grand jury, of course, is the grand jury that heard testimony and evidence and investigated the events surrounding the 2020 election in Georgia for more than 7 months and then produced a report that was released last week. So defense counsel for Chesbro has argued that those transcripts should be released to defense counsel. And then finally, there was a motion to disclose unindicted co-conspirators. And that is exactly as it is named, in that the unindicted co-conspirators, there are about 30 in the indictment who are not named, and defense counsel wanted those folks' identities revealed. Sidney Powell's defense team joined two of those motions before the hearing, and then I think adopted the last one during the hearing. It was kind of unclear, but it seemed to be the case that Powell's counsel was adopting all of them. So we had this motions hearing with Chesbrough's counsel and Sidney Powell's counsel. Those are the folks who have claimed speedy trial demands and have a trial set for October 23rd. Judge McAfee heard argument on all of these. He ultimately decided the following. For the motion to speak with grand jurors, he took that under advisement, although it seemed like he said that it would at least be granted in part. He seemed to focus on the fact that there were some workable ways to have defense counsel speak with the grand jurors with some maybe strict parameters, but he indicated that he would look at the case law that had been cited by the prosecution because they were very much opposed to the idea of defense counsel speaking with the grand jurors. And then on the motion to unseal special grand jury transcripts, McAfee said that that would likely be granted in part because he pointed out that if the state intends to call any of these witnesses at trial, they will likely have to turn over those transcripts anyway. He was not so sure, though, as to whether all of the transcripts would need to be turned over. For example, if it's someone that the state does not intend to call at trial. And then finally, the motion to disclose unindicted co-conspirators, that one ended up being moot because the state agreed to provide the names. And in fact, during the hearing, the state handed over the names of the unindicted co-conspirators to defense counsel. So that one was moot, and Judge McAfee indicated that he would enter an order saying so. So that was the outcome of the hearing. And it was an interesting day in court, Ben.
So, Anna, how long did the hearing run today? Apparently, there was also an order regarding severance with respect to last week's hearing. Tell us what arteries have been severed.
Right. So the hearing, I want to say that it was almost a little over an hour and a half, almost 2 hours, but I'm not sure because I was very keyed into tweeting about the hearing. And then afterward, we all kind of followed the defense attorneys out to see if anyone would have anything to say. Powell's attorney was not in the mood to talk, but Ken Chesbrough's attorney did have a little mini press conference. And in terms of the other things that are happening on the docket that weren't addressed at the hearing, we did have a big order that came down this morning from McAfee, big in the sense of not, it was many pages, but it was very significant because he determined that Trump and 16 other co-defendants would be severed from the defendants who have thus far requested a speedy trial. That is Ken Chesbrough and Sidney Powell, the folks who had the motions hearing today. And so McAfee said, okay, all 17 of these defendants will be tried separately from Ken Chesbrough and from Sidney Powell. But we still, as far as I'm aware right now, do not have a trial date. So that will be the big question in terms of, you know, the next big decision as to those 17 others. And then, of course, we had some action with the Mark Meadows removal appeal, but maybe we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. Let us check in as part of our ongoing project of evaluating different district judges. Are we still impressed with Judge McAfee?
I'm really impressed with Judge McAfee. I think he was very no-nonsense.
He turned 13 between last week and this week. So, you know, he's growing.
Once again, yes, he is very young. He is very new to the bench. But again, he was very no-nonsense. And I will say, you know, even beyond what his performance was today in court, he issued an order that was about this David Schaefer, you know, complaint about he received a mass mailing kind of advertisement, which law firms very often send out. It's often very automated. They look at court records and then just kind of automatically send out these mass mailing advertisements to potential clients who, you know, have recently been indicted. David Schaefer got one of those advertisements and made a filing about claiming improper communications because it was the advertisement was from Nathan Wade, who is the special prosecutor who has been working on this case for some time. He's in private practice, but was appointed by the district attorney's office to work on this case. So today, McAfee entered an order saying, you know, this case is going to have a lot of motions, and while this may be embarrassing for Nathan Wade's, you know, private practice firm for sending this, like, this is a frivolous motion, and I'm not going to entertain it. So please, in the future, don't bog down the court with frivolous motions. And I was really impressed with that. So I think he's going to keep things efficient. He said today at the hearing that he wanted to get the jury sworn by November 5th. As folks who have, you know, listened to me talk about some of the challenges with selecting a jury for RICO trials in Fulton County in the past might be aware, I'm a little bit skeptical as to whether a jury can be selected before November 5th if jury selection starts on October 23rd. But Judge McAfee says it's going to happen. He says he's going to maybe introduce some new jury selection practices drawn from the federal system to get it done. So we'll see what happens. But I am thus far very impressed.
Let us check in for the first time in several weeks on Judge Eileen Cannon. Speaking of judges, we have an ongoing process of evaluation of. She actually issued an order, a protective order, as best as I can tell, about 2 months late. Roger, what's up with that? And what's going on in South Florida?
Well, yes. Back in July, this is a CIPA case, of course, Classified Information Procedure Act. And one of the first things you do in a CIPA case is you get a protective order in place because before you can turn over the classified discovery, everyone has to agree how they can use it and how they can't use it. And usually that CIPA experts tell me that that usually takes about maybe 5 days, bearing in mind that the defendants usually want to get the materials. So they're usually not a contentious process. And, you know, if there is a dispute, what you could do is you could say, well, okay, I'll agree to this tentatively. I'll agree to your terms, and then I'll file a motion to jigger with the terms. Instead of doing that, Eileen Cannon set up, after there was a dispute that arose, she set up a 2-month briefing schedule. So the government first approached Trump with and at that point NADA with a proposed protective order in July 12th, and they were prepared to turn over 80% of the classified discovery then and there as soon as this was signed. And so instead, all of that has been in abeyance until now, and she finally issued the order. And by and large, it's pretty much, with respect to Trump, it's pretty much what the government wanted. The points of contention were he wanted a sort of a skiff at Mar-a-Lago in which he would be able to discuss confidential information with his lawyers.
I would like a skiff at my house too, actually. Yeah. And I think it's outrageous that the government does not provide me a skiff in order for me to review all the documents I'm not supposed to have, that I'm under criminal indictment for having illegally purloined.
Yeah, the order says nothing about that. You know, it's conceivable that the CISO, which is called a confidential information security officer, could approve such a thing, but even under this order, if he chooses to, but there's no indication that he will. Another dispute had to do with the language about sharing, whether the defense lawyers could share this stuff with, it says, you know, they can share it with their staff to who are security cleared. And Trump wanted a very broad definition of staff that would include like volunteers. And so that was a concern. That's not there. And then the other really related to Nauta and later D'Oliveira, the other defendants, whether they would be able to see classified materials. It's very common in SEPA cases for defendants not to be permitted to see classified materials, and instead you just permit their lawyers to see it. That is certainly what the government wanted to do with respect to Nauta and Oliveira, who aren't charged with Espionage Act offenses. It's possible Nauta at one point had a security clearance. He was in the Navy. As far as we know, D'Oliveira has never had one. He's probably never possessed a classified document or been trained in their use. So, and the outcome there again was for the government, neither will be permitted to view, as things stand, classified information, with the exception that Nauta will be able to see that document that spilled out of the box, you know, in the photograph in the indictment. There's one a document that, you know, the box toppled over and everything spilled out, and you could see a classified document very prominently. He'll be permitted to see that one. So it sounded like the government prevailed, but then moments later, the judge issued an unusual order asking for more briefing. And it's a little opaque because on Tuesday, right before this order was signed, there was a sealed hearing. And so the lawyers among themselves know what the dispute is about, and we really don't. But it seems to be that over this same thing about Nauta and Oliveira and whether they should get these classified documents, they as opposed to their lawyers. Their lawyers will be permitted to see all of these. The government concedes that. But whether they themselves personally get to see these classified documents. And apparently, it sounds like she's still troubled by that, because if you read Rule 16 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, ordinarily that sort of thing would be turned over. But the Classified Information Procedures Act alters a lot of those ordinary rules because of the urgent circumstances of protecting national defense information. And the judge seems very concerned about this, and she ordered astoundingly broad briefing. I'll read a little of it. She wants the briefs to evaluate, quote, the text of the provision, that's Section 3, the statutory context of SEPA as a whole, including the meaning of the words in Section 3 as applied throughout the statute, any decisional law interpreting Section 3, and any relevant historical, legislative, or secondary materials informing a proper understanding of Section 3. Included in this analysis should be a corresponding study of and comparison to Section 4 of SEPA, along with any pertinent analysis of Rule 16. And Section 4 deals with exceptions generally to the discovery rules, whether you can sort of redact documents, classified documents, when the government turns them over. So, you know, bearing in mind that these guys aren't even charged under the Espionage Act, it really suggests that she has a lot of discomfort with SEPA. And this sort of bodes ill, because right now we're at the easy part. You know, we haven't even gotten to the hard part, which is going to be what exactly happens when these are introduced in a public court hearing, because there's 30 years of practice that has evolved that, you know, permits unusual things, the silent witness rule, which we've you've done podcasts about, and I've written about things that are unusual. And if this gives her a problem, those are likely to give her a problem. And there's really very little 11th Circuit law. Most of these cases go in the Fourth Circuit. So I found that a little concerning.
And where are we in that briefing process? When did she order that briefing?
Oh, she ordered it yesterday.
And what's the time frame of it? I mean, she's basically asked both sides for, you know, a dissertation and treatise on Section 3 of, like, when does she need it by?
I don't have that at my fingertips. It was, but she also asked them sua sponte. She does a lot of things sua sponte. If they needed to postpone the Section 4, in order to do this, whether they needed to postpone the Section 4 step, the next step in the schedule, which occurs in October.
So is your impression here that, I mean, let me speak for the suspicious-minded people in the audience for a moment, that, all right, Judge Eileen Cannon has figured out that if you make outrageously pro-Trump rulings, you will get smacked down by the 11th Circuit, and you will be embarrassed and humiliated. But if you merely order briefing of everything in a detail that, you know, frankly, other judges wouldn't do, and you take forever to make perfectly routine rulings, and you ask for sort of picayune explanations and sort of treatises to be written on matters that are fairly routine, you can actually drag this thing out for a good long time. And by the way, you immunize yourself from a certain amount of criticism because you've set a trial date that's pretty reasonable, which then you'll push off as needed in small increments. So am I being unfair to poor Judge Cannon, who's just trying to do a diligent job here, or is there reason to be as suspicious as my question sounds?
I have my own conspiratorial suspicions, but they actually aren't that. By the way, the motion that treatise is due September 25th. I think there's something very odd about her approach to this case, and I think there is a reflexive. This gets into some armchair psychologizing, so you take it for what it's worth. But she does seem reflexively very hostile to prosecution positions, and which is surprising given that she used to be a prosecutor, or at least an appellate. In the appellate division of a U.S. attorney's office. And it's disconcerting. Now, Anna has actually been before her. I mean, seen her. I have not. This is what I get reading the bare text. But there's also odd things about, there's a lot of sua sponte stuff. There's a lot of striking of filings from the record without anyone asking that they be struck. And it's sort of the way Trump issues pardons. You know, it's like a power thing. And it seems almost like somebody who's insecure and wants to show I'm in control. Okay, so Dr. Parloff will now conclude with the psychology portion of this program and go back to our lane.
Well, I just think if you'd say had a few months after the 11th Circuit smacked you hard across the face and you'd said, okay, I really want to protect Donald Trump, but I want to do it in the fashion that least courts reversal and humiliation, being slow gets Trump 65% of what he wants. He wants to push this off past the election, win, and get rid of these cases. And if you can just stall it, you can do a fair chunk of that.
It's true, but what I think is What I am seeing coming down the pike is some sort of ruling that will endanger SEPA for the use, you know, across the country. And that will certainly require, yes, it'll get you time because there will be an interlocutory appeal,
right.
But it will get
and
you.
And SEPA rulings are, as an appellate, are appealable on an interlocutory basis,
yeah.
Almost uniquely among pretrial rulings.
And at that point, I think some judge might just take her off the case.
All right. Let's move on to our next judge now, Judge Tanya Chutkan, who is not Donald Trump's favorite judge. He wants her recused and filed a motion for recusal right after our last Trump trials and tribulations. So we're reaching deep into our memory here. Serafin, you're our Judge Chutkan watcher number one. Is she going to recuse, and does she have to? How good is this motion? And number two, what is the rule that, what's the right answer to this question? What's the case that Trump's making, and how should Judge Chutkan think about it?
The short answer to your first question, first part to your first question is, she probably will not rule in favor of Trump. And I'll answer the second question now, which is, what is going on? What's the rule? So Trump's team filed a motion to recuse Judge Chutkan under 18 U.S.C. Section 455A, which states that recusal is appropriate when the impartiality of a judge is reasonably questioned. And the defense cites two instances where they feel like Judge Chutkan has shown her biases against Donald Trump. They're both cases from the January 6th insurrectionists. In one case, she says to a writer that it's true that they had a blind loyalty to one person who remains free to this day. And then the second quote is related. It's similar. It's a different defendant. And she says to this defendant during sentencing that you make a good point. It's true that the folks who she probably didn't say folks, but she said those who funded and planned the January 6th events have not been charged and they remain free. And then she continued on to say, of course, that doesn't impact the sentencing that you receive. She also at one point said that she has her own opinions about January 6th, but she continued and said that that's irrelevant in this case. And so John Lauro and his team, which are Trump's attorneys, are making the point that Judge Chutkan, from these comments, is biased, or at least there is an appearance of bias, that she believes Donald Trump was behind the events on January 6th and that he should be charged accordingly. Now, what's a little bit awkward about this brief, and I think this is answering one of your questions, Ben, is it's awkward because it seems like defense counsel is implicating their own client. At no point does Judge Chutkan explicitly say that she's referring to Donald Trump in the two previous cases. And it's a conclusion that John Lauro and his team are drawing in this brief. Now, of course, reasonable minds can probably infer that she's referring to Donald Trump. But if you read her comments, again, she's not saying anything that's false. It's true when she says that one person remains free to this day, this person that you had blind loyalty to. The one person this defendant had blind loyalty to was Donald Trump, and at that point he remained free, continues to do so. It's also true that the folks who planned and who funded the events on January 6th had not been charged at that point. So there's really nothing of issue, it seems. And yet defense is making this claim, and they're citing some cases. Interestingly enough, a lot of these cases are outside the D.C. Circuit, which means that they're not going to be binding on the D.C. Circuit Court. The two cases that they do cite stand for a very different conclusion. So one case, for example, is about a judge who has a relationship with one side of a case, one party. And so in that case, the appeals court, the D.C. Circuit holds that there is an instance of bias here. And then there's another D.C. Circuit case where we have a judge who's making public statements and having interviews with the media while trial is ongoing. And that's not the issue here. So that brings me to another point, which I think is lacking in this brief. And that is that counsel does not go through the pains of analyzing the cases that they cite against the fact patterns in the Trump case. So, you know, that's typical of lawyering. You should be taking the facts of the cases that you're relying on and comparing and contrasting them to the issue in front of you. And that's not too much to ask. Both John Lauro and Todd Blanch are seasoned prosecutors. They both worked at white shoe law firms in New York City. They know this. And this brief falls quite flat to me. Now, the one case that they do cite is a Supreme Court case. I think it's a 1994 Supreme Court case by the name of Letecki v. United States. And in that case, the court sets out the legal standard to find judicial bias and decides when recusal is appropriate. It's a case that defense cites in passing, again, cherry picking the quotes that they like, but they don't analyze the case. And that case really does address the issue at hand here. In that case, Judge Scalia makes very clear that the opinions held by judges as a result of what they learned in earlier proceedings cannot be characterized as bias or prejudice unless they display a deep-seated favoritism or, quote, antagonism that would make fair judgment impossible. He goes on to say that, you know, disinterestedness does not mean childlike innocence. If a judge is to render a decision, then of course they'll have to reach a final judgment. And I draw this out because it's so critical. When I think back to the two hearings I attended of Judge Chutkan's, she made very clear that this is a court of law. We are not going to put politics in this. I'm not going to decide this case on political grounds. And that's not dissimilar from the Letecki case, where the judge also said that this is a criminal case. This is not a political forum. So the facts between these two cases are quite similar. And perhaps even more importantly, there have been so many moments with Judge Chutkan giving John Lauro time and space to just air out his grievances. He had a number of monologues where he just went off and talked about how this is a political case. This is Joe Biden and his cronies coming in and trying to, sabotage the campaign of President Trump. And she let him have that, those moments in court. Not to mention that she has ruled favorably for defense, specifically in the protective order context. So she hasn't shown this, you know, favoritism or antagonism that would make fair judgment impossible.
All right. So, yeah, I want to come back to Scalia's Letecki opinion for a second, because it seems to me, first of all, it has to be right. And the reason it has to be right is that if it's not right, most Supreme Court justices and most appellate court judges have to recuse from like a shitload of cases because they present issues that are related to issues they've thought about before. That's how we know what their views are on a bunch of things. So like, if you think about like the judges that we know who believe in X doctrine or not, or disbelieve in Y doctrine, that's because they've ruled on prior cases. And if the idea that that's bias rather than different people have different intellectual approaches to things, and you learn that about judges by watching them in cases, it seems to me it's pretty quick step to everybody's properly recused from everything they know anything about. Is there any distinction to draw there? I mean, there's no judge on the DC Circuit District Court, which maybe is Trump's point, right? That hasn't had a bunch of January 6th cases, hasn't had a bunch of sentencing, and hasn't been confronted by the argument, hey, yeah, I did X, but I did it because I was loyal to Donald Trump. Rogers sat in like 10 of those cases and talked about it on the podcast numerous times. Like, which judge doesn't have this, you know? And there's another recusal principle that if everybody has the same conflict, you don't recuse based on it. And so I'm curious, making the best case you can for Trump's side, is there anything in their motion about Judge Chutkan that is unique to her rather than simply a creature of the fact that there have been 1,200 of these cases in front of judges on her court.
Let me answer your question by saying something tangential, which is, I think it's hard to be sympathetic to defense because they don't make that point, Ben. You make that point. And I think it's a fine one that these cases have been heard by, I think at this point, every single judge on the DC circuit, that it's impossible to find someone that's impartial. And that's the issue here, is that they haven't done the work to make these arguments. They've just cherry-picked quotes from different cases and then use those cases to make the rules that they want, and then shared the facts of this case and then decided what's right and that Judge Chutkan should be recused. But putting that aside, if I have to be sympathetic to defense, I might make hay of the fact that Judge Chutkan said that she has her own opinions, and of course it's irrelevant. This is in the January 6th case, but that she's referring to Donald Trump, and that that personal opinion may in some way hinder her ability to be impartial. But again, we have this Latecky case, and Judge Scalia talks about this very clearly, that judges are allowed to have their own opinions. It would be, again, it would be impossible for them not to have opinions made up after previous trials or previous hearings, because that then helps them find have a final judgment, and that's of course going to carry with them in the future cases that they hear.
It's been a while since I've read the Rehnquist memo in the Laird v. Tatum case declining to recuse, but I remember that that has some sort of similar valence, that, hey, yeah, these are issues that I worked on. That's not the relevant question. The relevant question is there a client interest? Is there a recusal? Is there a duty to somebody that prejudices your ability to hear the case? I'd have to look it up. And so the government's brief on that matter is due today, right?
That's right. And we are waiting for it to come.
We have no reason to expect that Judge Chutkan will not rule promptly on that. She seems to be, unlike Judge Cannon, ruling promptly on things.
I think that's right. And in fact, this morning during our AM meeting, Roger made a good point, which is she might just rule on it. She might not even have a hearing. And it's something that I hadn't considered, but it's true. This brief is quite frivolous, and it would not make much sense for her to have a hearing when I don't think that defense counsel has done the work to put up a proper brief that takes the cases and makes comparisons and then reaches a conclusion that's up to par to, I think, what she would expect.
I did actually make a mistake this morning in that she did allow them 3 calendar days for a reply. So I don't think there will be a ruling before Sunday or Monday.
All right. Let's move on to our 3-judge panel on the 11th Circuit, which we now have an 11th Circuit appeal on the removal question. This is now back in Fulton County, and we have an emergency stay request that has another 11th Circuit panel that had a hearing tomorrow, canceled the hearing tomorrow. Dude, Anna Bauer, what is going on in the 11th Circuit?
Right. So if everyone remembers, it was on Friday, I want to say late on Friday, that Judge Jones, the federal district court judge, determined that Meadows would not be able to remove his case in Georgia to federal court. So Meadows, within hours, appealed that decision, or filed his notice of appeal at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal court of appeals in the district that the Northern District of Georgia kind of feeds its appeals to. And Meadows also additionally asked for expedited review and an emergency stay pending appeal, which basically meant that he was asking for the 11th Circuit to, in some way, pause the state court proceedings. It's a little bit unclear exactly what it is that he wanted them to pause, but at a minimum, he wanted the state court to not be able to enter a judgment of conviction against him. At the time, he was still set for trial with Sidney Powell and Ken Chesbro on October 23rd. Those cases had not been severed yet. And so Meadows asked for this stay pending appeal. appeal. The 11th Circuit panel that is hearing that motion for a stay was Judge Wilson, who is a Clinton appointee, and then Judge Jordan and Judge Rosenbaum, who are Obama appointed judges. They set oral argument that was supposed to happen tomorrow morning at 10:15 on this question of whether or not the state court proceeding should in some way be enjoined or stayed. And I was very excited to go to that or to listen to it on Zoom. And then right whenever I got out of the hearing for Chesbrough and Powell, a motion was filed by Meadows' team saying that he was going to withdraw his emergency motion for a stay. He noted that the 11th Circuit had granted his motion for an expedited review. They're going to wrap up the briefing by the week of September 28th. And he also noted that earlier today, Judge McAfee, the state court judge, had granted severance as to there were 17 defendants and then Chesbrough and Powell. So that meant that Meadows is very unlikely to go to trial by October 23rd. His trial will occur at some time later. I think, though, what is also going on here, Ben, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit more, is that with stay proceedings, one of the questions that the panel would have considered is the likelihood of success on the merits. And that means that they could have written a little mini opinion. And even though it's not binding precedent, you know, it tends to have some weight because there are different panels. So there's a motions panel that will hear the stay, and then there will be a merits panel that will actually decide the appeal about whether or not Judge Jones got it right to send the case back to state court. So I think what actually maybe is going on here is that Meadows realized that he really didn't draw a very good panel in terms of who might be more friendly to his arguments. And so he didn't want to risk having them write an opinion that in some ways went through the analysis and potentially, made the argument that Judge Jones got it right. So, but I'd be interested to see if anyone disagrees with that. But yeah, that's the update with Mark Meadows. So now we're just awaiting the briefing on the actual appeal itself, because that is still going forward at the 11th Circuit.
And do you think there's any chance of a emergency stay motion to the Supreme Court or to the en banc 11th Circuit? I mean, if Steve Vladeck were here, he would say this is what I wrote a shadow docket book about, right?
Well, I don't think they could do I don't think that the 11th Circuit allows stays pending appeal to go en banc.
But you could go directly to the Supreme Court about
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. But I mean, I can't say. It may be, but it feels like at this point, I don't foresee that happening, but you never know. It depends on if things start really going fast in state court, maybe.
Right. As long as they have time and we're not imminently heading to trial in state court, it's kind of harmless to let it play out at its own rate. The problem arises if you have a stalled, kind of plodding along what's effectively a collateral attack on the state proceeding going on while you're imminently heading to trial, then you start running into double jeopardy problems.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20. All right, let's talk about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Shift gears radically, move to non-criminal proceedings, different part of the Constitution, different, totally different parts of the country. And then we're going to go to audience questions. So I'm going to actually introduce this with an audience question. Jacob asks, Roger, is the 14th Amendment issue effectively dead, given the announcements by Michigan and New Hampshire that the Secretary of State offices don't have the authority to remove Trump from a ballot? Or is the Colorado court case still a live option? So, yeah, what does it matter that some secretaries of state are like, you know, I'm writing an op-ed in the Washington Post saying I don't get to do this?
That doesn't end it. We now have two serious cases. We have probably many frivolous cases. Some have already been dismissed. There is the case in Colorado that was filed, I think, last week. It's attorneys with the Crew organization. And then this week we had an interesting one. It's been filed. That one is filed in Denver, the second judicial district court. And it briefly was remanded. Trump remanded it, but then gave up on his remand and it came back. This week, we have this one in Minnesota where a different nonprofit group of attorneys are representing residents of Minnesota, and they filed directly in the Minnesota Supreme Court. And that's based on a statute there that purports to give, or does give, any individual a right to file a petition to correct an error in an official ballot, quote, including the placement of a candidate on the official ballot who is not eligible to hold the office for which the candidate has filed. And if the ballot concerns a federal officer, a candidate for a federal office, you file it in the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. So there's obviously been no response yet from the defendant is the Secretary of State of Minnesota, Steve Simon. Obviously, Trump will intervene in some way. So that could be interesting. And of course, it also starts at a high level, which means that the appeal might go to a high level. So that one is interesting. Meanwhile, there are lots of frivolous ones. What you cannot do is just go into federal court and ask for a declaratory judgment. And a lot of people do that. A lot of lawyers do that pro se, and those get thrown out without even anyone even opposing them, because you lack standing. There's no particularized concrete injury, which you need in federal court. You don't actually need that in state courts. And so these people that, these state statutes say any individual, or we saw this in the challenges to Madison Cawthorn in North Carolina, or Marjorie Taylor Greene in Georgia. The local statutes, and it varies a great deal from state to state, will give this right to any voter or any resident or any blah, blah, blah. And how it's dealt with, usually an administrative law judge or a commission, varies. And some states don't provide this. So like Arizona doesn't provide this. So you're out of luck. So some states can do it and some can't. And that's where we are. By the way, there's a curiosity here. You know, a lot of us have been wondering why Trump has not himself tried to remove the Georgia case. And a lot of reasons have been offered. And I will now offer still another one that's even more speculative than the others. But, you know, to remove the Georgia cases, the people have been saying, I was a federal officer. Well, one of the issues in these Section 3 of the 14th Amendment cases is whether the president is a federal officer. In other words, one of the defenses that certain scholars interpose for Trump is to say, well, if you read the gnarly language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, most insurrectionists are barred from most offices, but it turns out the president isn't one of them, because the oath you have to take has to be as a federal officer, and for X, Y, and Z reasons, we don't consider the president a federal officer. So it's conceivable he doesn't want to go into court and say, I was a federal officer, please remove my case. Now, that may be silly. Federal officer can mean different things for different purposes, but that's a possibility.
All right. So I want to add one thing to this, which is there is no way this issue is going to die without a resolution by the Supreme Court. And the reason is that there is some very clear constitutional language that raises a very substantial question about whether Donald Trump is eligible to be president again. And there are three essential components that have to be answered in order to resolve this question. And I say this without expressing my view of what the answer to these questions is. One is whether as Roger just says, whether the president is an officer of the United States within the meaning of Section 3's jurisdictional provision. The second is whether January 6th, Trump's role constituted engaging in insurrection. And the third is a bizarre question, but I think a real one, whether this 1870 amnesty law effectively, which is, you know, technically still on the books, effectively erases for congressmen. There are other questions like what's the enforcement mechanism? There's also the question of whether this is self-executing. You have to answer those questions. And as long as you don't answer those questions, some secretary of state or some county commissioner who controls the ballot is going to say this person is not eligible to be president. And some other one is going to say, yes, he is. And you're going to have a conflict between those. And the result is that you're going to have appeals, and this simply has to be resolved. It has to be resolved by the Supreme Court because there's no other court that is competent to resolve it for everybody. And that means effectively that you're going to have a lot of procedural machinations in various different states in order to try to get different mechanisms to rule on it. And ultimately, the Supreme Court is going to have to consider it. Do you agree with that, Roger?
Yes. I think that the 1872 or 18, there's a second amnesty too. I think those are sort of dead in the water at this point. People may make the argument. We've moved on. The self-executing is an important issue. But yeah, I think this is a real scary thing because we're talking about a train wreck with violence, people very upset. Being excluded from the vote or their candidate being. And so we need a fast and definitive resolution before it gets worse and worse. If it's somebody tries to resolve it after the election and he's won.
All right, John, you have the next question.
I feel like the immensity of litigation calls for like a really snazzy Google sheet with fancy formulas and visualizations to track these dockets. I mostly say that because I can't keep track of them in my head anymore, and usually I can. So the question is, does anyone know of really a good public Google sheet that tracks all this stuff in a useful way?
So the answer to that is no, I don't know of a good Google sheet. But we do have three docket pages on Lawfare that are tracking the three Trump cases that are kind of within Lawfare's jurisdiction. We don't have a docket page for the New York case, but we do for Mar-a-Lago and Fulton County and January 6th. We are working on a tracking document, a calendar, I think. I'm not sure if it is going to be a Google Sheets or a calendar, but we are working on a mechanism to a cross-docket kind of action document. Anna Hickey, do you want to say what we can say about that at this point?
Sure. Lawfare is hopefully going to have, by the end of next week, a Google calendar that will have all of the court dates for the ongoing Trump trials to make it easier for everybody to figure out what hearing is happening when, because it is getting pretty confusing.
All right, John, your second question.
Thank you, Anna Hickey. So my postscript was, at the beginning of this morning's hearing in Fulton County, there was a discussion about oral motion practice versus, in the federal system, everything's on paper for the most part, and kind of how the state court proceeding was sort of seat of the pantsy. And I thought it maybe merited some discussion from you all. And I wonder where it will go, because I think it's a serious issue when, you know, stuff gets decided on the fly with limited briefing. And I think defense really had a good point to make there. And I haven't heard much chatter about it really anywhere.
Okay, so I will just say we talked about this last week in the context of removal. And one of the arguments that Anna and I and Alan Rosenstein made in our piece, which was quasi-sympathetic to the defense on the removal question and was treated with the deference it was due by Judge Steve Jones, was that, you know, there is a radical difference in technical competency. And I don't mean competence here in the sense of incompetence or ineptitude. I don't mean it that way at all. I just mean institutional capacity between a big federal court that has complex litigation all the time and a comparatively very small caseload, by the way. You know, it has relatively few, but very big, very complicated cases, and a local county courthouse that, granted, it's a big city courthouse, but, you know, they don't deal with this kind of case very often. And you see that when, you know, as Anna points out, you try to pick a jury in the Young Slime Life case, and it takes 8 months, and you don't have a single juror seated yet. You know, and that is does not happen in the federal court in Atlanta. And so I do think there is just a institutional capacity difference. And you're describing one aspect of that, which is an important aspect of it, but it's by no means the only one. I do think in this case, it is mitigated by the fact that, to go back to an earlier point that Anna and I were talking about, that Judge McAfee is a very serious guy. And, you know, this is not a Lance Ito situation, for those who are old enough for that name to mean something, where you really have a judge who is just out of his depth in managing a courtroom with the eyes of the country watching him. And I think Judge McAfee is doing a really, really good job so far. That said, this is the trickle of what is going to be a major flood. And I do think, you know, this is one of the better arguments for removal of at least part of this case to federal court. Just the court itself is better postured to deal with litigation of this magnitude. Anna, do you have further thoughts on that?
I mean, my only thoughts are just state courts are going to state court. Like, in state courts, it's not just Fulton County. Like, this is just very common in state courts in general. It operates it's very different from federal court. It's for the reasons that Ben just explained with institutional capacity. You know, there's other reasons, but I think that, you know, what we saw with Rafferty is someone who's maybe more used to federal practice, who's coming in and, you know, it has these complaints, which I think are very valid, because, you know, I understand that defense attorneys, to be zealous advocates for their clients, you know, they should get citations in advance of a hearing, but that's just not how it usually works in state court. And the defense attorneys who were there, who, you know, are state court defense attorneys, you know, they weren't complaining about it because, or for the most part, they did, you know, have some complaints about the PowerPoint not being available beforehand. But, you know, they kind of know how it goes. And I don't know that it is going to be an issue, just because this is how things go in state court. It's a little bit more fly by the seat of your pants. And I'm not really sure that there is anything that the defense attorneys could validly raise in terms of a legal challenge to that. But it's an interesting point, and it's a good way of also pointing to why it's really important to be following and reading coverage from people who are familiar with how things work in Fulton County and in Georgia State Court, because, you know, there's a lot of analysis out there from folks who are very used to how things work in federal court. And often we've seen through this entire investigation from the special grand jury to now have seen that very often principles or things that would usually apply, rules that apply in federal court, just don't translate to state court. So, but interesting question. Thanks, John.
Julia, you have the next question.
I have been watching with not a little amusement at the comic relief, the plays that go on outside the federal courthouse in Washington, D.C., and the signage and all of that.
Were you appropriately amused by the anti-circumcision protester who was accosting everybody for a while? No first in, no peace.
I was very much amused by that fellow.
He's my hero.
No, I'd like to come to D.C. and hang out outside that courthouse just to watch the movie, because it's a movie out there. Anyway, I do have a question. Because of the movie out there, apparently there's now an issue in Navarro's case, because the court officer took the jury out in the middle of deliberations out to get some fresh air, and they were exposed at some level to some of the shenanigans going on outside the courthouse. And now I understand that Navarro's attorney has raised an objection, thinks that maybe the jurors were unduly influenced by the fuckery that was going on outside. Can you just talk about that? I mean, is it a serious thing? Should we be worried about that?
Roger, do you have thoughts about it?
From my reading in the press about what happened and what was known, I'm not too concerned. It's sounded like a lot of speculation so far, but Judge Maeda is taking it seriously. He's going to allow, he's going to produce the surveillance cameras footage from outside the court to try to see what a sign said. We don't even know that. We don't know what sort of sign it was that they might have been exposed to if they saw it.
No foreskin, no peace.
Right.
And would that be biasing?
I mean, it all has a grasping at straws flavor to it, to me. But I guess we have to see what they can develop. There's also maybe a timeliness issue. You know, the jury has now been excused, and this is coming up a little belatedly. So I'm skeptical, but Judge Maeda will track it down to the extent it can be tracked down and take it seriously.
But if, as I recall, he has not lost jurisdiction over the case, right? He could just declare a mistrial and retry it, right? It's not a, or would you have a double jeopardy problem with that?
I don't think there would be a double jeopardy problem, since it's the defense coming for, I mean, it's the defendant coming forward and asking for a new trial. So you're right. You could do it again, and it would take a few hours.
You know? Yeah. Like the first one did. You know. Ian, you have the next question.
Hello. Hey. Everyone's excited about the 14th Amendment, but under the 22nd Amendment, anyone who's been elected president twice can't become president again. And Trump lost in 2020, but he and lots of his supporters, including presumably a bunch of red state secretaries of state, continue to claim that he won. Could this be a basis for a challenge to Trump's eligibility? Or does like elected mean the actual electors and the counting of the votes and all that?
Yeah, so I think it would be a really bad idea for anybody to acknowledge that he had been elected a second time, who wanted to prevent him from assuming office. You don't want to feed that particular narrative. That says, as a formal matter, he was not elected a second time, no matter what you think of the of the integrity of the vote. The vote took place. There were certified results of that election, and they elected electors who, in fact, cast votes on December 12th. Those votes were counted on January 6th, albeit in a sort of interrupted fashion. That is the election. And so there is no question that as a formal matter, Trump was not elected twice. So at least on that basis, he is eligible, at least in my view, to be president a second time, however much it pains me to say it. Bob, good to see you. You get the next question.
Thank you, and thank you for having this forum. On the 11th Circuit Meadows appeal, I saw that in ordering an expedited briefing, the 11th Circuit posed its own question as to whether the removal statute for federal officials applies to former federal officials or whether it just applies to current federal officials. That's something I hadn't thought about before. I'm wondering if the panel has any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I have no idea what the statutory right answer to that question. I noticed it too. I will say I think it would really frustrate the policy purpose of the relevant statute if it did not apply to former officials for conduct that took place while they were active officials. Because if the goal of the statute is to prevent state prosecutors from harassing the federal government in the fashion, in the conduct of its federal obligations, I can't really see how it matters if the person has retired in the interim or not. That said, that's a policy argument, not a legal argument. And I don't know what the right answer from a statutory interpretation point of view is. Have you looked at this at all, Anna?
Yeah. So the 11th Circuit, when it was asking for additional briefing, it pointed to the text of 28 U.S.C. 1442, which is the removal statute. And the first part of the statute says, you know, that a federal officer can remove for, you know, acts that are under color of office. But then the second part of the statute, which deals with a different removal provision that's not about federal officers, but it specifies that, you know, if you were, I think it's like, I can't remember the precise language, but basically it says like either a current or a former or at the time you were XYZ, then you can remove. So the 11th Circuit was contrasting those two provisions to say, well, if Congress, you know, thought that former federal officials, not just current federal officials, could remove their cases to federal court, why didn't they also specify this in this first provision of the statute? So that's kind of what was going on textually. So it is a plausible reading of the statute that maybe Congress didn't intend for former federal officials to be able to remove to federal court. However, Mark Meadows points out in his brief that those two sections of the statute were passed or amended decades apart. So that could be one of the explanations. It's not like, you know, they were passed together. So that could be one of the explanations as to why they have that differing language. I also will have looked into some of the cases. There's not a lot of direct case law on this question, but I think that, you know, I will say that it seems like there are examples of former federal officials who have been able to remove mostly in civil suits, but that's largely because most of the case law in this area is about former federal officials being sued in civil suits and then removing to federal court. There's at least one example that I'm aware of a circuit case that involved a criminal prosecution and the federal officer by the time he was prosecuted and the circuit court took it up. He was then a former federal official. So I think that it's something that has been long been assumed because of the policy reasons that Ben, made the case for. I think it's telling that Fani Willis didn't initially make this argument because it's something that I think that if they had looked at the statute and thought it was a compelling argument, they would have gone ahead and made it. But with that said, they did make a, you know, really compelling case in their brief. I will be surprised, though, if the 11th Circuit's opinion turns on this question. I think that it's all going to still come down to the scope of office question.
All right. We are going to cut off the Q&A now because we have three more questions on it already, and I want to get through them all. Graham, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Ben. I'm still musing, or maybe rather bemused, by Judge Cannon's order for the extensive SEPA briefing. And I have to imagine that most of the case law on this is centered around DC or perhaps Maryland or Virginia. So I guess it's not too surprising that a district judge in some far-flung corner of the US might not be a SEPA expert, but I would guess that they should probably study up on that on their own rather than order a sort of law school remedial briefing on it. But maybe it's not clear if that's what she's doing or whether it's this delay. I guess we don't really know her motivation. But I guess the question is, you mentioned that it's justiciable to the appeals court, and I'm wondering what it would take for her to do that would cause such an appeal to be raised.
Roger, do you want to take this?
Sure. It's certainly true that the lion's share of these cases are brought in either the Fourth Circuit or the D.C. Circuit. Fourth Circuit has a lot of the intelligence community, the CIA, the National Security Agency. And the Fourth Circuit has had the most of these SEPA cases, which is a specialty. The 11th, I mean, there have been cases in the Florida, and including recent cases, SEPA cases.
And big cases. The Noriega case was in the South Florida District Court.
Yeah. So it's not like we're out in the Hicks or something but it's a surprising ruling. The government early on, filed an overview of what SEPA is and why it was enacted. It's about 21 pages. It describes what each, because the government never assumes the judge has had one of these before, and explaining what each section is about. To put the best face on it, there's some language in the discovery rule, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 16, that sounds mandatory, that the defendant is supposed to get certain things. And SEPA, an act of Congress, does contradict that and in certain ways. And so maybe it raises a question of, well, which one was enacted first? The rules of criminal procedure do have the status of a statute. So can you harmonize? Those are legitimate questions, but I'm surprised it's not a new question. And the extent of the briefing, she wants to know about Section 4. She wants it is very odd to me. I can't really explain it. I don't think it's, personally, I don't think it's just about delay. I think it's something else. And as to what would cause an interlocutory appeal, anything that endangers that sets a precedent that is going to make it difficult to prosecute these sorts of cases, because that's what the intelligence community and the U.S. Attorney's Office both fear most, that some judge that isn't familiar with this will do something and they'll be stuck. This will not just ruin this prosecution, it'll ruin all prosecutions. So this is a big, it won't take much if it's way out of the ordinary to cause the government to have to take an interlocutory appeal.
There's a general, the idea of SEPA basically is to balance or harmonize the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights to a fair trial and to confront all the evidence against him with the government's need to protect classified material. And so there is an idea that there are, you're going to put before the court all the classified material you might have to use in either defending or in prosecuting. And then you're going to come up with appropriate summaries or substitutions that can be presented unclassified. Any ruling that affects the answer to that question is appealable on an interlocutory basis. And so sometimes there are a lot of interlocutory appeals before a SEPA case goes to trial. Here you have 31 documents that are charged. You could have appeals on any or all of them. There's also any material that Trump might want to use where the government's going to say, no, you can't put that, you can't use that in open court. They're going to have to figure out an arrangement. Any ruling that affects the answers to those questions are appealable on an interlocutory basis. And I agree with Roger, it will not take all that much for the government to take her up, partly because they really want to establish the record that she is not playing with a full pack of cards. All right, we're going to go through the last three questions quickly. Michael.
Hello, good evening. I'm trying to follow this from the United Kingdom. And from a UK unitary point of view, these two trials involving Trump for very similar, with substantively very similar in the accusations, is very peculiar. I can't imagine.
Yeah, well, we fought a war with you guys to try to have this divided sovereignty thing where, you guys didn't devolve a parliament to Scotland until 10 years ago or something.
Okay, yeah, you're right. And we're very far behind. So we'll catch up. No, my question was really, you all give the impression, or what I've read, is that the two sets of prosecution teams cannot talk to each other. Or should not talk to each other. And I'm not sure if there's a rule for that, or it's just politics. I could argue that from the point of view of justice and efficiency and the use of taxpayers' money, they should actually talk to each other. Otherwise, we're throwing money away.
Yeah, okay. So it's a good question. And the answer is people are overstating the rule. Here's the rule. There is no rule that says they can't talk to each other. There is a rule that says the federal prosecutors cannot share grand jury information except under very limited circumstances. Federal grand jury information is very, very tightly protected. Beyond that, there are prudential reasons why they might not want to talk to each other. Like, for example, that Donald Trump is out there alleging that there's a big conspiracy and these people are all working together. So one way of not feeding that is by having very limited or no consultations. But there is no rule that says that they cannot talk to one another or coordinate with one another. And sometimes, by the way, federal law enforcement does coordinate between states and with states. To the extent that people are saying they cannot talk to each other, that's just not true. There's an important exception as well to the grand jury secrecy limitation, which is that they can talk to each other, they can share grand jury information for a legitimate law enforcement purpose. I forget the exact language of the Rule 6e exception, but it's reasonably capacious within I think it's for a valid federal law enforcement purpose or something. I forget the exact language. But if there's a good reason to do it, you can do it. You can't do it recreationally or socially. All right, Joyce, it says, please ask for me. The commentariat has noted that Chesbro and Powell have pursued the speedy trial gambit in hopes that Fannie Willis is not ready for trial and that they can be acquitted. But this choice is revocable. It seems that her office is really ready to proceed with only 5 weeks to go before trial starts, and the entirety of discovery has not yet been delivered. Asking you to speculate, are they really going to go to trial on October 23rd? I will just say my speculation is I don't know what Sidney Powell is up to, but I think Chesbro, for the reasons we discussed last week, wants to go to trial immediately and thinks if he goes to trial and just says, I'm a lawyer representing a client, he wins. That's my guess. Anna, what do you think?
I will say that today, and remember, this is right after Chesbrough and Powell have effectively gotten what they wanted, except from being severed from each other, which is to be severed from everyone else. And today, Chesbrough's defense attorneys represented to Judge McAfee that they might have some interlocutory appeals that they would like to pursue before the trial on October 23rd, and that would then toll the speedy trial demand. So
I'm wrong.
He hasn't yet ruled on anything for them to appeal. So, I mean, I don't know how they would know that they have, other than, you know, the severance motion, but in terms of Powell and Chesbrough with respect to each other. But so just something, a hint that maybe they are not being fully committed to the October 23rd trial. So we will see.
Nothing concentrates the mind like a hanging, and the equivalent of a hanging is going to trial. Simon, you get the last question today.
Thanks very much. I'm back on the grand jury's charging recommendations from Georgia. They, among other things, recommended charges against three senators who have not been charged. Lindsey Graham's case has been pretty extensively covered in the media. I haven't seen much about the other two. I was a little bit struck by the fact that although there was a lot of speculation about members of the House being somehow involved in January 6th, that there were charging recommendations against people in the Senate, but not people in the House. Are there reasons to think that there were very different roles played by these people? How much do we know about the role the other two senators played that were against whom charges were recommended? Is there a different legal status depending on whether you're in the Senate or the House?
Anna, you want to finish us up with thoughts on this?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a tough question. It's a good question, but it's a tough question to answer because that special grand jury report tells us so little about what the special grand jury was considering in terms of evidence, what the scope of the investigation was. There might be reasons why Fannie Willis didn't look at what members of the House were doing because maybe they didn't have relevant conduct that they did in Fulton County for jurisdiction or venue purposes. You know, there's all kinds of reasons as to why maybe Senator Perdue and Senator Loeffler or former senators would have been looked at, whereas members of the House did not. What we do know about Perdue and Loeffler from publicly available information and reporting on the special grand jury, the report itself recommends Perdue for indictment in two areas. One has to do with communications with various people in the state of Georgia to basically pressure them to overturn the election. And then Loeffler is also recommended for indictment in the more general recommendations around folks who were, who participated in the conspiracy. There's also a footnote that the grand jury mentions that one grand juror thought that the statements by Perdue and Loeffler, while pandering to the base, I think is the term that they use, or pandering to their base was not criminal in nature. So we have an idea that it relates to, potentially some statements that maybe Perdue made that the grand jury believed to be either themselves false or, soliciting false statements. That's the code section that they cite to. And then there's also reporting that the grand jury potentially looked at this meeting that Loeffler and Perdue had with Brian Kemp, where they tried to allegedly pressure him into calling a special session of the Georgia General Assembly to overturn the results of the election by, Georgia the legislature appointing electors in favor of Trump. So there's a lot of things there, but I just don't know what exactly the grand jury looked at and had in mind in making its charging recommendations. So unfortunately, I can't really answer the question, but it is a good question. And I wonder if Ben or Roger or Serafin have any thoughts about, you know, maybe why we didn't see some of these other folks.
I will just say that the speech and debate clause is a big nut to crack. And Fani Willis may have just made the decision that that was not an additional burden she wanted to take on. And oh, by the way, in Georgia, the senators were more active than the members of Congress. May have been different if you'd been in Pennsylvania, but in dealing with some of the more active members of Congress. But in Georgia, Lindsey Graham and the sitting senators from the state were the people who were really engaged. We are going to leave it there. We have gone on a long time. Roger Parloff, Serafin Danani, and Anna Bauer from the hideous pink chair room of her palatial mansion, thank you for joining us. We will be back next week. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineers this episode were Isabel Kirby McGowan of Goat Rodeo and Anna Hickey of Lawfare. Folks, if you want to join the conversation, be part of it, have your questions answered, not just to hear it, but be part of it, become a material supporter of Lawfare. You can do that at lawfaremedia.org/support, and you can be on the part of the conversation that actually talks the next time we do Trump Trials and Tribulations. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.